It's a great joy to have a family satsang with satyogis who have all earned your spiritual warrior feathers. But I chose tonight to come for three main reasons, and then I'll open the floor to see why you're here. One is to welcome Ram back to the ashram. It's a joy to see you again, brother. I mean, what is an ashram without Ram? It's just an ash, you know? You bring the essence. I appreciate it. And I hope we'll catch up and find out what's happening in your abode in the valley soon. Okay. And second, I wanted to emphasize that the video lecture that we saw last night, which I heard was made a bit incoherent by the rain, and as well as by the subtitles that were wildly inaccurate, which they always are, and probably by his speed of talking, that it is worth your time to listen again, maybe even more than once, because it is a brilliant example of extraordinarily profound reasoning and rhetoric that connects all the dots of postmodern philosophy, psychoanalysis, literary theory, Deleuze and Guattarian philosophy and schizoanalysis, and as well as Plato's metaphysics and that of the whole classical tradition, and puts it together into an extremely well-connected argument that arrives at the same conclusion that Satyoga has reached through a different path. And if you can grok his concepts, you will then be able to integrate the Eastern and Western mindset that will enable you to have the ability to communicate, I think, much more clearly and coherently with whoever you may be delivering spiritual knowledge to. And I think that his approach, he is putting together, let's say, for the most part, the Lacanian theory of psychoanalysis, and connecting all of that with these other elements, such as Kafka and other novelists and thinkers. But the point that he arrives at is that everything happens through your own choice. There is no one and nothing you can blame on the other or on the environment for your fate. You have chosen that destiny, but not your ego has chosen it. Your ego is the artifact of a choice. Who made the choice? The choice is actually made by the sanskaras left over from previous lifetimes. Incompleted gestalts and attitudes and orientations and frustrations and all the maya that was not resolved and overcome in previous lifetimes, all of that karma must be settled in this lifetime. But it is projected into the dream field from those collapsed qualium wave functions that constitute the structure of what becomes the ego in this life. And that includes embedded within it the choice your ego has made, whether to be neurotic, psychotic, or a pervert, or all three, or any other combination, and how those attitudes will then be enacted and expressed in the events that will be predestined to appear in one's life as repetitions of the traumatic situations which created the sanskaras in the first place. And when you understand that, and that you have the freedom to eliminate all of that karma and maya at a single stroke by the simple recognition that you are not the ego self. Because when he used the term, you are no self, he meant the small s self. But when you recognize that you are the unborn absolute consciousness, free of the need to identify with the ego complex and its thought patterns, you can choose freely to disidentify and to eliminate that egoic residue and decollapse the qualium waves and transform your life miraculously without waiting. So I think it was a very important lecture and series of insights that are worth your study time in order to internalize fully, so that the old patterns of egoic acting out no longer appear in your mind stream. So that was the second reason. Now the third is that it has come to my cognizance that we have yet another retreat coming up soon. And I know I'm going to be asked about it, so I thought I would do a preemptive attack and talk about the next retreat a little bit. Its title, I believe, is The Practice of Self-Mastery. And so I want to talk a little bit about why that topic and what its significance is, because it is one of a series of more advanced and direct teachings than have been offered in the past, because we are now in a moment of extreme acceleration of time as we approach the culmination of Kali Yuga. And very rapidly, there will be ever more extreme events and tamasic energies and obstacles that will appear in the dream field, to the extent that self-realization has not been attained. And it is, in fact, possible and not even difficult to attain the supreme liberation, Jivan Mukti, while alive in the body, here and now, immediately, if one has accurate understanding of the nature of reality on the symbolic level, one has the love for that supreme level of your own being that you have been alienated from, and you can attune to the vibrational frequency of that supreme presence. If those three are in alignment, then the portal opens. So the practice of self-mastery then, it refers to what are the preliminary and or direct and immediate means of attaining this realization using these three aspects in integrated congruence. And the various wisdom schools of the Eastern tradition, as you know, because we've talked about this many times, have categorized spiritual seekers into persons of different levels of readiness to achieve the breakthrough into the real and the letting go of the false self. And so, in a way, there is more than one practice. The Kashmir Shaivites divide their training into four levels, although it's really three because the top level is no means, immediate. But the second is the Shambhavopaya, which is the same recognition through cognizance and attunement and devotion, it immediately without obstacle. But if there are obstacles, then the Shaktopaya or the Anavopaya means of practice are required or advised in order to break through those obstacles. So this means you need to be able to assess your psychological maturity, your capacity for love, and meaning infinite love, love for the infinite self, and your willingness to be free of egoic identity and to feel the intensity of the presence of the divine energies in their fullness. Without interruption. And this is very rare that one has all of those ready, willing, and able developments within the psyche that enable that immediate liberation. So we will, in this retreat, deal with some of the preliminaries for those who are still, let's say, more enmeshed in their identification with the body ego. And those who have overcome most of those identifications but are still identified with the mind and the thinking capacity and the use of the mind for defense and for management and protection and for the development of various applications of mental capacity need to learn how to be able to transcend those without loss of those abilities, but in fact, their enhancement once one's identification with the particular way of using and identifying with those mental and emotional and artistic and logical uses of the mind for practical as well as for, let's say, recreational purposes of the development of the joy of self-expression, how one needs to be able to let go of the level one is on in order to be able to return to the employment of those powers, but from the level of the absolute self, so that your capacities that you have gained with hard work and the development of abilities to manage, to cope, to serve, are enhanced by being now used in the service of God rather than the service of the ego and its jouissance. So it's this transformation that comes after transcendence and leads to the full embodiment of the absolute self and the final non-duality of nirvana and samsara. All are implied in the concept of self-mastery. And so that's what the retreat will be about for those who are ready to engage in the rigorous practice necessary to attain the goal. So I think that's all I have to say about the retreat, unless anyone else has any other questions about it. And with that, I am going to open the floor to any questions of anyone about anything we've been studying here recently, or any of our sat yoga concepts that are unclear, or obstacles in your own path, or whatever you wish to speak about or ask about. And we have people online, and they are also, of course, welcome to participate. I suppose we'll pass the mic if you, if anyone has any questions. Here's one. Do I have the mic here?
You actually set up a mic here.
Oh, okay. So I guess it's a standing mic only.
About the movie we watched last Saturday. I can't remember right now.
Bury My Heart at Wounded Knee.
There you go. Bury My Heart in Wounded Knee. And there was a particular scene that to me was very meaningful, and yet I want to make sure I have the right understanding, symbolic understanding of it, and the message that was conveyed. And it is when the protagonist...
Ah, that's better.
So it's the scene in the movie where the protagonist, Charles, actually is in turmoil. He goes to the river, and he's, of course, as we know, an American Indian, Cherokee, or I don't remember exactly the...
Lakota.
He was a Lakota, but he was raised in the, let's say, Western tradition, and he had this...
Actually not. He really entered into the reservation and was given by his father into their custody when he was already seemingly a teenager. So
like
he was raised as a Lakota Sioux.
Okay.
Yeah.
And he has in a piece of cloth, or maybe it was a suede or leather kind of fabric, he has a cross and a feather.
Mm-hmm.
And of course the feather, you were explaining to us in the essay that you wrote, was the Lakotas and maybe other tribes' understanding of their origin as, I don't know, fallen from the sky. One could think of an eagle, of an angel, of a being that flies much higher levels. And then he had the cross, the Christian cross, which was given to him by his father, and he had both together. He didn't seem to be able to make up his mind, and he, I remember he actually didn't throw it in the river, or maybe I missed that part. He kept it, but I'd like to hear a little more about, since you're wearing a feather, that's what reminded me of that scene, to make sure I understand what it means, and obviously a very symbolic scene that might be also understood and brought to this time that we are living right now, and how does that, how can it be used to better understand the times we are in, and maybe some decisions that need to be taken?
Well, I wouldn't attempt to give the meaning of that scene, because perhaps it has different meanings to different beings and with different subjective relations to both of those symbols and to the story itself. But what I took from that was that there was an internal struggle within his soul and his heart as to his identity. And these two symbols represented two different beings that he could have been, and that he was never able to commit fully to the choice of the cross over the feather. He wanted to jump off the train when it was taking him into the world of the white devils, right? So he went reluctantly only because of loyalty to his father's will, etc. But he never lost his identification with that eagle feather, which signifies the warrior who protects the tribe and serves the tribe and would die for the tribe, right? And that loyalty to his people, at the same time, because of his need to understand, to empathize with, to relate fully to the whites in order to be able to serve by representing the native peoples to the colonial government, if you will. Required him also to be able to speak as a Christian, because that gave him credibility as one who had become civilized and who was then entitled to have a voice. Remember, he couldn't speak in the classroom if he didn't take on the name of a Christian name, right? So I think he battled throughout the film and throughout his adulthood with being torn between these two identities. And I think that was the moment of a choice, either to throw them both away and enter into emptiness, or to reconcile the two and find a way to be able to be at home in his heart by recognizing, perhaps, and this is my own speculation, that the cross of the risen Christ is like the eagle that flies from the earthbound state and is able to have a panoramic view of the phenomenal plane from that place of the Great Spirit. Okay? And so I think he could have chosen either to be free of both, or to integrate both and keep them both in his heart, but also that would mean that reconciliation was an overcoming of the particularity of an identity into a universality of being. And I think it was that then enabled him to be at peace with himself in going forward to complete his service in that life. Mm-hmm. And we have, I think all of us, and especially going back to the lecture of last night, where every being who comes into the world is split between the drive to be and the drive not to be, which I take being meaning to return to your essence, the upper death drive, and the lower death drive of just wanting suicide and getting out. that there is a tear between these two, and that the lower death drive with the desire for jouissance and for dissipation of one's life energies and meaningless pursuits versus the transcendence of ego into that absolute nature where one can serve with unconditional infinite love is also the same struggle that each of us has in our own lives, whether or not we are even conscious of the fact that this split drive is creating either a paralysis of will or a fanaticism or one of those three psychic packages of neurosis, complaining about others and reality, or the psychotic completely unable to even suffer as an individual being, but falling into delusion, or the pervert who gets completely sidetracked into particular drives of jouissance that enables them to tune out the other levels of suffering in their being, etc. So it's only when we have reconciled that split drive and overcome the split, which then leads to overcoming the other splits between subject and object and self and other and all of the dualities that plague our capacity to be in the true essence of who we are, that we also must make that inner journey in our own way, as he did in his. And that theme, I think, is universally relevant, and perhaps even more relevant for us, because we are now in the position of a conquered native peoples in our own planet. The human species is now have been cornered in the reservation and is being massacred more than the numbers that died at Wounded Knee and all those other battlegrounds by all the various depopulation plots that are underway, including ultimately that of global war. So I think we are in a parallel, if not congruent, position with the beings in the film, which is why I showed the film, and that we are having to make the same choice of either spiritual heroism or the lower death drive of some kind of futile resistance, or simply blacking out, tuning out, and living in denial of what is happening and what is our responsibility as children of God and manifestations of the light. So that's how I would reply to that.
Thank you.
Thank you for the question.
Thank you for the teaching so far. And so we're talking about like bringing opposites together and like the reconciliation of samsara and nirvana,
mm-hmm.
and then the topic of like self-mastery. So like a question that's kind of been coming up specifically like during times of seva and like working is like the task that the body is performing, is it a limitation on its ability of attunement? Like, is there a certain level that can't be reached because the body's in an active state? Like, does it need to be, like, to go to the deepest levels, does one need to be total stillness and
no.
seeing?
Well, this is what Sri Ramana taught and Nandamayama and all of the great sages is actually know what we need to learn is first that we're not the body, and that the body's job in its phenomenal manifestation is to serve the community and the light in all the ways that we are called to do, but to remain in God consciousness so that the bodily icon itself vibrates with that frequency during the whole day and is able to transmit an energy field of peace and empowerment and love and joy to all the beings in the field and to keep that energy field as a protective aura for the whole community. So the difficulty is that it takes rigorous practice to do that, because it's very easy to externalize and forget. And it takes a very conscious and deliberate effort to remain in that inwardness while the body is active. And that's the real practice of karma yoga that we must master if there is going to be real total self-mastery. But I do believe that you first have to get it in sitting meditation, that because it's much easier when you can close your eyes, tune out the world, and forget that you're a bodily being and have that vehicle to care for and enter into the infinite space of pure awareness. But then when the body gets up, you must recognize that there's no difference between sitting and being active. And there's no difference between meditating and not meditating, because the self isn't the one who meditates. The self is just constant presence, and it requires such a disidentification from the mind that will become active in whatever seva is being done with the presence to whom that mind is simply another object in the field that is functioning for the purpose of serving the will of God, but without any identification with either the work and concern for the outcome, but just concern with doing the work in the most mindful way possible, and with complete disidentification and complete freedom from any need for getting credit for how much you worked and you did it overtime today and you went beyond the call of duty and why don't they, you know, give me a gold star and, you know, give me more praise than I get. So one has to be free of all of those egoic needs in order to remain in that state of absolute love and joy and goodness without needing anything back from an illusory world. And that can be done, but it can only be done when you are willing to make the choice to be free of the illusion completely and to never forget that you are unmanifest consciousness that has never been born or created, and this icon is simply a vehicle that is being used at this moment for the particular requirements of the theodrama to fulfill a part that is required by God for the completion of that divine supreme will. And you are an instrument of that will. Okay?
Yeah. Thank you very much.
Thank you for the question.
It seems that I'm feeling a relationship between this rigorous practice of remembering who one not is not and letting that go,
mm-hmm.
And that rigorous practice that then allows one to connect to those qualium waves of love and joy and insights and wisdom that come with play.
Mm.
And it's this aspect that perhaps I'm finding in kind of a retrospect, an integration of both the rigorousness and and the playfulness that integrate somehow.
Yes. Well, I think all play is done with great rigor and seriousness if one wants to become a virtuoso in that form of play. And everything, every game or activity worth playing is worth practicing and perfecting the art of that particular expression of one's being. So musicians play, but they rigorously practice if they want to be professional level musicians, right? And the same is true for scholars, and the same is true for yogis, of course. So there's no contradiction between rigor and play. And I think that the more committed one is to being able to play at a very high level of beauty, of brilliance, of power that inspires and uplifts those with whom and for whom one is playing, I think brings the energies of the ideal and the sublimation channels into their full development and sublimation to the real self, so that that power of inspiration comes through and is downloaded in the expression of that play in whatever way it unfolds, so that it is not you, the individual, playing, but God playing through your vehicles, both mental and physical. And it's the playfulness of God's sense of humor then that brings the real joy to the activity. Okay.
So do you also think that perhaps it is it may start as, you know, rigorous practice, and at some moment what was rigorous practice just becomes more of a natural play, and there isn't a conscious effort of practice.
That's true. It becomes effortless, but it can still be rigorous, you know, in the sense that the practice becomes ever more precise, you know, but the effortless way one gets to that precision becomes one's second nature and more automatic, with indeed without effort. But to get to effortlessness takes a lot of effort, right? Wu Wei is a very high achievement, and it does require the transcendence of the ego, but the employment of the capacities, whether it's manual dexterity or cognitive capacity, to be able to deploy those powers in one's activity without the ego interfering in the flow, so that it is a flow state and not an ego state that is being enacted.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. And your question actually brings up another aspect of the retreat that I wanted to mention then, is the difference between self-mastery, becoming, let's say, a swami in the sense in which that term is used, as one who has mastered the small s self, and a siddha or a mahasiddha, which is one who has gained let's say, the paranormal powers that are latent and potential within the consciousness through a rigorous practice of such special development. And most of the sages, and including Patanjali, of course, in the Yoga Sutras, don't go for the siddhis, go simply for realization of the self and the citta vritti nirodha, the complete cessation of mental activity. And whatever siddhis are required will be given at the moment they are needed. But if you try to become an empowered being, you will develop an ego that becomes proud of those attainments. However, I do find that once the ego has been transcended, that the deployment of the special potentialities of consciousness may well be developed not by an ego any longer, because that will have been transcended, but by the egoity of the Supreme Self, you could say, in its use of the particular instrument that is the one that you are responsible for, to be able to fulfill certain functions that require certain siddhis. And these will develop if there is no resistance to the unfoldment of those latent capacities. So there isn't a contradiction or a choice that has to be made, but the attainments have to be done in the right order, or else there could be an obstacle created if there is still a tendency of the ego appropriating whatever powers begin to emerge. So it's important not to make your goal to be a siddha, but it may be the final outcome of the development of mastery that will be given as a way of special expression of the power of the God Self that is intended to demonstrate the reality of that supreme power to others who require such signs of power in order to increase their own faith, which I think was the reason for the miracles of Yeshua and of other sages famous for such charitras, such performances. And I think that one shouldn't be afraid of those attainments, nor desire them, but they may indeed come as the final unfoldment of one's process.
Thank you, Shinya. I'm curious if you can help me to understand more how to recognize internally the upper death drive, because I feel very aware of the lower death drive within my own mind, and I'm seeing it externally in different settings, but I'm having a lot of difficulty finding that connection to the upper death drive in the same with the same clarity, right? I can hear you speak about it, and it I try to let it inspire those drives, but I feel like there's an imbalance internally with the, I want to say the ease with which I identify with the lower death drive. And you know, I want to heal that split that you're speaking about within me, and I want to be able to allow the charitra of this being to unfold in its most
sattvic way. Yeah. Well, I think the very expression that you are offering of that yearning for the upper death drive is in itself the upper death drive. So it is manifesting more than you recognize. I think there may be a suppression of your ability to perceive how spiritual you actually are because of a need to identify with the lower death drive to satisfy the superego and the attachments that the ego has to a particular way of being that became the comfort zone of the ego and the milieu in which your ego developed, in the same way that that guy in the movie Charles grew up or at least entered adulthood in a milieu of Christians and he still though had those sanskaras of childhood as an Indian. In a certain way, your childhood sanskaras were more of the lower death drive type, not of the higher, because your family system was not made of saints and sages who were highly religious and devoted and all of that. And so the ego ideal was actually attached more to the lower death drive than to the upper. So the undoing of that sanskara then requires a lot more power of the soul to be able to fully confront. And yet, it is happening because otherwise you wouldn't be here and you wouldn't be engaged in the rigorous practices of seva and of meditation and of all of the learning in this wisdom school that you have been very studiously trying to internalize and to bring into activation that upper death drive and the realization of the self. So I think what we're seeing is that it's happening below the surface, but it is already happening, and at a certain moment there will be a breakthrough and a crack in the ego's facade, and you will no longer have to pretend to believe that you are only connected to the lower death drive. Because I think it's only the discourse of the ego that is sustaining that false self for whatever reasons of attachment it has to that old identity, and that at a certain moment the light of the real will break through through a descent of grace that fully transforms the drive and unites the lower with the upper, and all of the energies of the lower chakras rise into their fully sublimated form. And then all of the powers that were engaged in the rigorous development of an artistic prowess, but serving the lower, will now openly serve the higher without any loss of those capacities, and in fact an enhancement of them. And I think that is underway, but it's not under the control of your consciousness. And at a certain moment, the grace will overcome the facade of control that the ego has and of inability to want the higher, because that's not the reality. And that this question will be perceived as a false one, and the ascension of the kundalini energies will take place instantaneously.
Thank you, Shunya. I appreciate always your ability to encourage and to speak to what's unable to be seen. And I feel like the ego structure is more, my ego structure is more focused on the frustration and being, that's part of what it feeds on.
That's neurosis. Has nothing to do with your ego. It's a universal structure today. Don't take it personally.
And there, because there is at the same time a growing trust in just allowing mm-hmm. the unfoldment. But at the same time, like there's moments where I fall more deeply into that frustration and just mm-hmm. it affects how I interact with others. And I don't like how mm-hmm. it affects the way I interact with mm-hmm. with others.
Sure. But remember, there is only God. You cannot be anything else other than the one supreme intelligence that pervades everything and everyone. You have to be that. You can't be anything or anyone else. There is no other option. So the part your ego is playing right now is perfect. It has to have this frustration and this internal split. It's part of the Theo drama for your character to have that until a particular moment predestined in which there will be a transformation and a complete revelation of your divine nature and the beauty of your angelic being that will play music that will bring others into divine trances of ecstatic bliss. And that moment will come, and you will be more surprised than anyone else that is happening.
Maybe so. Thank you so much.
Thank you. We have a few more minutes. Is there anyone online with a question? No? Okay.
Well, thank you for all of this inspiration and encouragement, indeed. My question is kind of related to a couple of the recent questions, and it's been something that I've been wondering about in terms of this rigorous practice as well in play, where, like, I like to play in terms of creative expression and singing and playing guitar. I guess sometimes this doubt arises of, am I distracting myself from the rigorous practice by doing these things, or am I actually in the upper death drive with it? And so there's a doubting of my intention sometimes. Should I be doing this, or should I rather be meditating and studying? And so very often there's, I guess, at a deeper level, an issue with time, and am I using it in the best way? And it's also something that then comes up if I don't sleep well and I'm not able to make the best use of my day, or I need to sleep more in the morning and I can't meditate as much. And so, I guess there's it's an obstacle in the way that it creates doubts in the mind, let's mm-hmm. say, these quandaries. So mm-hmm. I was wondering if you could help yeah. with that.
Actually, the doubts are what create all the other obstacles. Mm. The obstacles don't create doubts. Okay? So self-doubt is the essential nature of the ego. That's that split drive. Should I be doing this or should I be doing that? To be or not to be? Mm. It, right? It's that same conundrum and confusion that can never be resolved because there is no central intelligence in the ego that can balance and unify this split drive into harmony. Mm-hmm. So this is the situation of the ego. And that frustration and indecision is why you don't sleep well also, right? Mm-hmm. And so it has that function of furthering the suffering, the maya, the sense of lostness and hopelessness in the ego, because that's the way the turn of the karmic screw will finally force you to get very serious about overcoming the false identity of the split mind. And becoming present to it. And the way to resolve this in the highest way, which your ego cannot do, however it will happen as a result of grace, is that there will be simply an acceptance that the situation you are in now with this confusion and doubt is perfect, okay? Mm. This is exactly the way that your destiny must unfold. You have no choice in the matter. So to enjoy the situation without becoming in anguish over it will itself transform the situation. And then that joy will begin to motivate the singing and the guitar playing and whatever are the other activities that are now seemingly a distraction, and they will become an act of service and of karma yoga and of the development of your soul's ability to express your divine nature. And no longer will there be any doubts or confusions or split. And you'll see that everything was meant to happen in a way that would ultimately be able to be sublimated into the highest use for the will of the God Self that you already are, but that you're not allowed yet to know because it's required in the drama's unfoldment for this to develop unconsciously. Until that moment with the breakthrough of total consciousness and the realization of the perfection of all of it. But the more that you are able to adopt that attitude that the drama is God's will, you didn't create it, you didn't decide to be born, sanskaras did that, but even those are part of the will of God. And so become the witness of this drama of frustration and doubt, rather than identifying with the mind that can't make the decision. And then there will be an awareness of the divine beauty of the way that it is all unfolding and your own role in becoming a devotee of that supreme intelligence that understands all of this in its perfection without any sense of duality between right and wrong, good or bad, and samsara and nirvana. And you'll see you all along you've been in nirvana, but you haven't known it. And there's nothing that needs to be done at all, and no doer.
It's a very valuable answer.
Hallelujah.
Hallelujah. Thank you.
Namaste.
A question from Navid.
Navid or David?
Navid.
Navid.
Navid. I've heard Shunya speak on the top-down approach in previous teachings. I wonder if he could elaborate on it.
Well, the top-down approach means to accept the truth of non-duality. Okay, and to accept the perfection of everything, as I was just saying, and the realization that one intelligence is guiding, directing, pervading everything and everyone, and realizing that you are a manifestation of that one supreme energy that is ruling the universe and all that unfolds in it, and is in fact the one who is experiencing all that you perceive. So you have to recognize that you are being dreamed by the supreme dreamer, and that the dreams of the ego are fractal subsets of the dreamer of the cosmic dream. But that ultimate dreamer is the self of every being, including you. And by recognizing that you are that and being devoted to that supreme level of your being and the being of all that is, you invite the descent of grace from the top to the bottom, to the ultimate embodiment at the level of the Anamaya Kosha. And then you will feel the power of that unlimited blissful presence pervading your life without your having to do anything from those lower levels to be worthy of it, because there's no that's an illusion. There can't be any unworthiness because everything is perfect. And so all of those disqualifications that the ego creates to justify its jouissance and its laziness and its distractions and all of that, all of that falls away because of the recognition of the perfection, and that everything that is mandated by the will of God is actually manifested in ground level reality. And by understanding that and surrendering to that truth, then the fullness of that power becomes realized at the level of the body itself. Okay. All right. 1 minute left. Any last questions? Every question's been answered. Everyone's at peace. All are completely liberated here and now. That's wonderful. So everyone go out and get a feather and put it in your cap and be self-recognized as the manifestation of the angelic eagle that you are, who is here to serve through the power of being able to soar, to fly to those regions of light and love and wisdom, and then bring to the earth that power in manifest form for all others to benefit from as a bodhisattva. Thank you all for your dedication. Namaste.